Welcome back to another edition of the Brocast Recruiting Edition for Rivals.com. I'm Brandon Huffman alongside Tracy McDonald of Bruin Report Online. And you know, Tracy, we were just talking before we got on about Big Ten Media Day coming up next week. I know the Big 12 did theirs 2 weeks ago. The ACC was last week. The SEC is this week. And then next week, the Big Ten gets going with their Media Day in Chicago, back in the Midwest. Was in Vegas last year. But you know what that usually means when Media Day is coming? It means football season is just around the corner. And I think the UCLA coaches, who have been on a bender since really Bob Chesney was announced as the hire shortly after the Sun Belt Conference Championship game, they've been taking some much needed time away from recruiting. The NCAA dead period gives them that opportunity, but it's also giving you and I a chance to recalibrate, catch our breath, and prepare for the high school football season as they come. So not a lot of recruiting stuff going on in the 2027 class. However, we are now in what, week eight or so, what will Brady Edmonds do? Tracy, what's the latest that you're hearing on the big righty from Huntington Beach High School?
Yeah, the big thing right now is that there is, you know, no real movement in that situation. And, yeah, it continues to just be a wait and see with Brady. And, you know, like we've touched on previously, UCLA, you know, finds themselves at the very least in a good spot as he, you know, continues to wrestle with the decision of whether he wants to stick with his Ohio State commitment and what that'll mean, whether he decides one way or another for UCLA's future recruiting endeavors when it comes to the quarterback position.
It's, again, as we've gone over ad nauseum, we brought this up just about every time we've touched on Brady Edmonds. UCLA does not have a quarterback in this class. Clearly, there's not been a panic. They've kind of set who they wanted as their guy. They had offered a couple of other guys that they didn't really get a lot of traction with, a guy like a Blake Roscoff, who ended up committing to Washington. Obviously, there was the pursuit of Colt Nussmeier that, you know, somewhat got off the ground, but it feels like it's been Brady Edmonds or Dane Weber. Obviously, Dane Weber went to Cal, but Brady Edmonds, the fact that they maintained as much of a presence in his recruitment, considering when he committed to Ohio State, considering that Ohio State didn't bring in another quarterback, I think it still, you know, gives credence that, like, hey, UCLA must feel decently good about the chances of flipping him. I'm not saying that they feel decently good that they're going to flip him, but at least the chance exists. And in the next couple of weeks, we'll start to touch on the broadcast who are some of the 2027 quarterbacks that UCLA fans should get to know, should keep an eye on. Is there a DJ Bordeaux type out there? But I think the fact that here we are, it's been now 19 months, almost 20 months since Brady Edmonds gave his commitment to Ohio State, and UCLA still has a puncher's chance, says a lot about this program. And again, it's a depth thing. You know, there's obviously the chance that UCLA could lose Nico to the draft. There's always a possibility that, you know, Matt Nyamaliava isn't for sure starter. He could leave, or Ty Diefenbach could end up somewhere else. You do have a DJ Bordeaux, but at one point, you know, maybe even a year ago, you know, when you were first covering the season when Deshaun Foster got it going, they had what, seven quarterbacks on the roster at one point, and Carson Gordon left. Now running track, I want to say, well, I think he's playing football as well, but he's at SMU. Is that sound right?
I don't know. I can't remember if I saw him make a decision. That you'd probably have a better pulse on that than I would, but
that's what Google's for. I'm gonna Google that. I think Henry Hasselbeck left in that time as well. Luke Duncan now at Austin Peay, by the way, is where Carson Gordon ended up. Former UCLA tight ends coach Jeff Ferris at Austin Peay. And then, so Luke Duncan, Carson Gordon, and Henry Hasselbeck all left. And, you know, they've added since DJ Bordeaux and Ty Diefenbach. But, yeah, it'll be interesting to see what this quarterback situation will be from a high school quarterback standpoint. And Again, we by no guarantees, and I think we saw this with a non-immediate pivot to a Ryan Rakowski or other players, that UCLA is content to just sit back and wait to see if there's a 2027 quarterback that emerges this fall, or just go get a guy who is a freshman out of the portal, with especially the 5 for 5. Now you're still getting a guy that's going to have 4 years. So there's a lot of options. We'll dive into those a little bit more. But yes, Brady Edmonds is really still the only 2027 to watch. And that's largely because there have been so many commitments already made, 23 in all by UCLA. Now, the Bro staff did a piece earlier this week on the 5 best 2027 recruiting wins. We'll touch on them. We're going to go through them. And then we're going to add a couple that could have made it. But these are the ones that went with. 1, UCLA shocks the field for Jackson Roper. 2, UCLA flips Jerry Outhouse from Georgia. 3, UCLA snags Miles Baker from Cal. 4, Matthew Gregory spurns Nebraska for UCLA. And 5, Montana Toilolo chooses UCLA over 3 playoff semifinalists. First, Tracy, your overall feel with that top 5. Was there one that you're like, maybe that wasn't as big a win, and one that was missing that you're like, that should have been in there?
I know, you know, Montana had, offers from, like, Miami. I believe Notre Dame was also in there.
Penn State.
But it always felt like he was going to, give the local schools a chance to keep him home. He was high on UCLA as far back as, I want to say, if not last spring, maybe even 2 springs ago, back when Kaikum Loy was still recruiting him. And at the time, they were his only real contender. So that's one where maybe considering how highly rated Juju Johnson is, I probably would have maybe swapped him in there, just because, you know, you keep a talent who is a 4-star who could have easily challenged for a 5th star and still has time to before his high school career wraps up. Someone who's already signed an NIL deal with Nike for his upcoming high school senior season. Just keeping somebody as high profile as him in the area. He plays at Long Beach Poly. I think was a really big message that Bob Chesney was able to send as far as in-state recruiting goes, and his mostly new staff that's foreign to Southern California, aside from, the likes of Colin Lockett and Vic Soto and a few others. That's probably the one where if I had to swap one, that'd probably be the one I'd be looking at.
Okay. I would tend to agree that there was one that, could have been in there. It was Juju Johnson. The one that I also thought may have made a case to be in there. Again, this one slips under the radar a bit because of when it happened. And the reality is, Colton McKibben playing in New Mexico it at times can be over out of sight, out of mind. It's funny. I was at Chase Field this week for an Arizona Diamondbacks game, and that was my first time going to a baseball game there, but I was there in December for New Mexico's bowl game, and I am sure the entire state of New Mexico was also at that game. And I saw a tweet yesterday saying, the number one player, Max Preps this week announced that Colt McKibben is the number one player in the state of New Mexico, high school player, and he's leaving New Mexico to go to UCLA. And it was the New Mexico game that ultimately led to the demise of Deshaun Foster. Well, you could turn around and make a case that a few months later, with UCLA landing Colton McKibben, that was kind of the first indication, like, this is not the previous staff's recruiting efforts. Here's a guy that UCLA fans, I don't even think even really knew that they were recruiting him, let alone getting a guy who's been a 4-star from the jump, the best player in New Mexico, will be the first Navy All-American ever from New Mexico. And a guy that I know is at Arizona State. I saw him at an Arizona State game last fall. ASU has done really well in New Mexico the last couple of years, not too far from there. That was another one that I think could have made a case to be in there, just because it too came out of nowhere. The timing, who they were beating for it, that was one that I think that, you may look back at in a couple of years. And, you think about one of the best, the one of the best linebacker classes the UCLA has ever signed. It was their 2010 linebacker class when they flipped Jordan Zumwalt late. They got Eric Kendricks, who ended up being, you know, one of the best linebackers UCLA's ever had, and signed a running back named Anthony Barr, who ended up becoming an All-American linebacker. I'm not saying at all he's going to win a Buckus Award like Eric Kendricks, become a 10-year NFL starter, be instrumental in a coaching hire, you know, 10, 12 years after his playing days are done. But Colt McKibben could turn out to be one of those sneaky, really good pickups that you may look back in a couple of years and say, hey, this one was actually even more significant from what he brought on the field, but also from a, you know, perception standpoint. It's just maybe it's me. Maybe it's not as exhilarating when you go get a player from New Mexico, when you're going and getting a Montana Toilolo who's at Mater Dei, or a Miles Baker at a Sierra Canyon that you're from Cal. You're going to get a Juju Johnson. Any other ones that you thought could have made a case to be, if this would have been a top 10 list, maybe that's a top 10 biggest recruiting win.
I think Kingston Selfie, just looking at the speed that Colin Lockett brought into the receiver position, a lot of, track athletes in that group. He's another four-star recruit. Someone I believe Cal was also highly interested in, and some others. So that'd probably be my other one that probably could have made a case for. But I think for the most part, that top five is pretty solid, pretty sound.
Sure. Honorable mention, you mentioned in the story that with respect to Khalil Terry, I mean, that one always felt like that. Even going back to a year ago, that one seemed like it was a matter of when, not if, he would end up ultimately at UC Broadcast a while back. That I took a picture of him when he was a sophomore going into his junior year, and at the time was committed to Michigan State, wearing the UCLA beanie at a 7-on-7 tournament. So it always seemed like that was going to happen at one point. And then you could even say that George Toia, just getting him out of the state of Texas, even though he's a California guy, more importantly, I think with the Akaika Molloy's track record with the Toia family, that was another one. But again, I think we'd all agree that Jackson Roper was a big one, just given the timing. And, even when you did the article with him after his unofficial visit, I mean, this kid is a phenomenal interviewer. I don't know where you would rank him, but I mean, this is the most thorough, well-spoken kid. In fact, this is going to sound really random, but Tracy, I would say the two best interviews in the 2027 class in the West region are both from Colorado. It's Jackson Roper and then Troy Maalo, who ended up committing to Stanford. Just some of the most thoughtful answers that you get. But when you talk to Jackson after that unofficial visit, I mean, did you even see any signs like, hey, UCLA is going to mess around and get this guy?
Yeah, I think I was more so just surprised by how in-depth he was and how, serious it turned out to be. Because when you think about somebody who, like we've touched on previously, UCLA wasn't in his top 10 going in to the visit. He had only talked to Chris Smith, but never actually met him and sat down with him. So there were just so many other factors still at play. Just getting him on a visit was probably a big win in itself, getting him to check out a spring practice. But then, when I think back to like you mentioned in your own interview, just how detailed he was, how much he gushed about everything. You could tell he was already one just a media darling. If you want to pick one guy who's you can already tell is going to be a great interview down the line at the college level, it's him by a mile. Just because you talk to a lot of high school kids, and I don't blame them. They're a lot more tight-lipped, maybe just don't have as many different things to say about different schools. They'll a lot of times bring up the same things because, schools are seeing the same strengths that others are in the recruiting process and all. But he was looking at things from, just all kinds of aspects. And he already clearly knew what he wanted in a program. So, yeah, he was someone who was impressive from the jump. And that's always kind of been my impression when it comes to offensive linemen in general, as far as the high school recruiting stage of it all. They are pretty easy to talk to, pretty open, pretty candid about things. And he very much fits that mold.
You know, it's funny because you start to think with all the media days coming up, you know, who are the guys that will be well represented at various media days? And usually it's the quarterback or it's a, you know, guy who is an all-returning All-American. But my goodness, I mean, not to pick on Deshaun Foster, we all know how disastrous his first Big Ten media day is. But if you take Jackson Roper to a Big Ten media day here in the next couple of years, not only will he tell you where UCLA is located, he will be able to tell you all the pros and cons of the city of Los Angeles, despite only having been there for a year or two. I mean, the guy is going to be a wordsmith. He already is a wordsmith, and it's fitting because he'll be playing for Chris Smith. Okay, but seriously, folks. The number two one, as we touched on, UCLA flipping Jerry Outhouse from Georgia. Again, one of those that indicates that, like, hey, this is a different, you know, a different era. The fact that UCLA was even in it to be the runner-up to Georgia in the first place for a corner from Texas, you know, says a lot. The fact that they were able to flip him, a guy that that Georgia wanted and coveted heavily, is big. And, you know, you can always tell when it's a loss that hurts a fan base, because a lot of Georgia fans have been obnoxious to him in the last couple of weeks, especially since he took his official visit, was posting pictures of him in the jersey. Oh, he only did it for the money, all that. That's when you know SEC fans are getting in their feelings, is when they start, you know, taking shots at the kid. But that was a big one as well from who UCLA flipped him from. Especially, this wasn't like a guy who got dropped by Georgia. This wasn't like a guy who committed to Georgia a year ago, and now Georgia was like, hey, you know, we're moving on. It was, what do you mean you're spurning us for UCLA? That was pretty significant.
Yeah, and, you know, just like you mentioned, he's from Texas, and for UCLA to plant a flag there, they also got, you know, someone like Jayshon Gibson. You mentioned George Toya, even though he's more of a Southern California product than a Texas product. But, you know, I know the staff likes defensive backs from Texas on west. So for him to kind of be a tone setter in this class, and to see how vocal he's been about, you know, wanting to continue to add to the class, and, you know, he's consistently tagging, you know, someone like Brady Edmonds about his decision. Before Brady, he was, you know, hoping that he could get Colton Nussmeier out of Texas to join him. So, you know, he's one of the more, I guess, prominent guys on social media as far as UCLA commits in this class, and someone who, you know, you look at his size, and he offers quite a bit of potential, still has plenty of room to put some weight on. He's a bit thin in his frame, but someone who can be moved around a little bit, plays corner, but could, you know, he's talked about talking with the secondary coaches and, you know, possibly getting a look at safety, nickel, wherever they kind of need him. So yeah, he was someone who definitely raised some eyebrows pretty early on.
What I like about him too is that he's got a little piss and vinegar to him, but he doesn't do a lot of talking on the field. But you could tell that there's a chip on his shoulder, and that could be from, you know, playing on the same team, although it doesn't look like he's going to actually get to play with him this year, with John Meredith, who is perceived as the number one corner in the country. And that could be something that, you know, with the Juju Johnson, those two guys played opposite each other. We saw them at OT7 playing opposite each other for the Wonder Warriors. And then they were at the opening finals. Juju Johnson beat Jerry Outhouse's team in the championship game when the West beat the Southwest. But, you know, both are maybe playing second fiddle at times, despite being very elite to a teammate who happened to be the number one and two corners in the country. But, you know, Outhouse, he had a great tweet this week saying, hey, you know, the pads are popping in 2 weeks. And that strikes me as a kid that's going to come in with a lot in his mind that he feels like he's got to prove. And, you know, you want players like that, not guys that are content with where they're at already. Guys that are, you know, top 10 and still feel like there's nine spots that they should be up higher in the rankings. But a significant win for UCLA to get him from Kirby Smart and Georgia. Third, we touched on this one a little bit last week, but I thought that given the constant battles we started to see with Cal in this class, UCLA getting kind of the last word flipping Miles Baker from the Bears, especially days after it looked like he had reaffirmed his commitment to Cal on his official visit, was going to visit LSU, and then ends up visiting UCLA. The Bruins flip him. A pretty big win, though.
Yeah, and, you know, he just adds even more intrigue to that season opener at, you know, in Berkeley. I believe it's September 5th, I want to say. But, yeah, just a very clear sign that UCLA and Cal are not going to be slowing down in their recruiting battles with first-year head coaches at their respective programs, with Chesney and Tosh Lupoi on Cal's side. Again, somebody who we've said it over and over, you know, position versatility is a big thing with this secondary in the 27 class, and he's someone who's more of a hybrid linebacker type of safety. Again, somebody can give you a different look, help you in some run support and that sort of thing. So, and to do it so late in the process and, you know, essentially come out of nowhere to gain his commitment late, at least in terms of the surface, even though, you know, UCLA, as I mentioned in our past story with his father, they had been working behind the scenes pretty diligently since at least March. And the communications really started in January, but March is when things really started to, kind of gain a little bit of traction. Miles definitely deserving to be one of those five.
Tracy, you are the hardest working guy covering UCLA football, so you took a much deserved, well rested weekend. Greg Biggins saw him at the 7-on-7 down in Orange County, and he was the Rivals MVP on that day. But like you said, you know, you talked about his body, his frame. You know, it's not going to be a surprise if he does move up in the box and ends up becoming a linebacker at some point, playing that hybrid safety linebacker role. But a big win from a perception standpoint, a big win for who they beat, but also from a talent standpoint, especially coming off the heels of losing Kane Brackney, just to give them another guy that could end up being a linebacker or just stabilizing an outstanding secondary class. So that's the third number three win. The number four was Matthew Gregory spurning the Big Red for the blue and gold. You were, I think, already at Loyola at Marymount for OT7. I was just getting ready to get into my my lift to head over, and we saw the news that, hey, Matthew Gregory is committing to UCLA. Like, all signs were pointing to Nebraska. His visit moved up a couple of weeks to Nebraska, and it felt like it was a matter of when, not if. And then UCLA got him. I know you talked to him a couple of times. Again, beating Nebraska is one thing, but I think it was, the timing of it, how it just so quickly happened. It went from like, okay, when is he committing to Nebraska, to no, he's committing to UCLA.
Yeah, and, you know, very opposite to what I mentioned just a little while ago about Miles Baker, where, you know, you could at least see some of the traction starting to gain with Matthew Gregory. It was, you know, it was a Steve Wiltfong report that, hey, he's going to visit. And that, you know, again, he admittedly was not somebody on my radar, especially considering some of the receivers they already had in the class. You know, so that was a very much a genuine surprise, much in the way Jackson Roper was a pretty genuine surprise. But again, less time to kind of get in there as far as you know, how they made it happen, and like you mentioned, all signs had him pointing to Nebraska. Every prediction had him pointing that way, and someone who continued to show that this UCLA coaching staff is not messing around, and they're going to take their share of swings. You know, there were some guys that they definitely tried to also get on board, someone like a Dante Wright, the corner out of Long Beach Poly, and teammate of Juju Johnson, who, you know, at one time was at least considering UCLA, but they weren't able to get in there. But again, the staff's not afraid to put in the work and at least to make a run at some big time players, and Matthew Gregory I believe still a four-star, but outside of the Rivals 300 in the latest updated rankings, if I remember correctly. But again, still someone very talented and someone who, again, just kind of let everyone know that the staff will go out and recruit, whether it be Southern California or, in his case, the Pennsylvania area, where, you know, Chesney and a lot of the staff is familiar with. So that probably helped a little bit also, just knowing the region that he's in. So, yeah, a very strong choice there at number three.
Montana, Tori Lolo, you mentioned, you know, that was one that UCLA had always been on the shortlist for. But there was a time where it felt like with some of the defensive linemen that UCLA had been making progress with, whether it was him, you know, George Tuia, who they ultimately got, the loss of Akaika Molloy would really hamper UCLA's efforts. And, you know, as the story said, they beat Notre Dame, Penn State, two teams that were playoff semifinalists. Notre Dame was a finalist 2 years ago, and then Miami, who was the runner-up, to get Montana. So this is, you know, granted, he's a modern-day kid. He's a Southern California kid. But they were beating a couple of schools that have had really good defensive linemen in the last couple of drafts and have done a really good job of developing and turning those players into guys. And again, it's like Colt McKibben being from New Mexico. At times, maybe you take for granted with a guy who's a three-star like Montana, but this is a guy that's going to be, you know, probably a three-year starter, maybe a four-year starter at modern day, was a part of a couple of state championship teams and national champs. But as you said, you know, UCLA had been in it. When Akaika Molloy left, I mean, did you feel like maybe that was the opportunity UCLA squandered with Montana, or was there just something that he always kept coming back to with the Bruins that made them the pick for him?
I think with them, it was, again, his interest was already there with UCLA. It was just this coaching staff kind of continuing to make him feel at home and that sort of thing, and prioritize him really early, right? Like, he was one of the earlier commits in this class. And I think the other big thing that, again, sending a staff sending a message and showing that it can recruit Southern California, you know, pulling somebody out of the Trinity League at a big time program like Modern Day, it bodes well for that relationship with the school. And, you know, it's a pretty strong one already, considering the job that GM Derek Ray has done and the contacts he has there, including recruiting coordinator Rudy Cambero, who's on the Modern Day staff, as well as you know, some of the familiarity head coach Raul Lara already had with Derek Ray from his time when he was at Fresno State. So yeah, this one is just as much about the player as it is the impact of what it did to, again, set a tone in a big time Southern California program. And, you know, they've also got, you know, his teammate Mike Davis Jr. committed, and they're going after plenty of 2028 and 2029 modern day kids. And, you know, depending on how Montana's experience shakes out, could bode well for, you know, some of their big time prospects coming down the pipe to also strongly consider UCLA in the future.
Like we said, there's a couple that could have deserved mention: George Tuia, Khalil Terry, Juju Johnson. But again, that kind of leads into a story that Tracy did on Wednesday. And UCLA just, you know, there's the wins. But UCLA just flat out beat some schools that have been thorns in their side in years past. I mean, Cal and UCLA had quite the rivalry when it came to recruiting. So it's fitting that those two schools will open up against each other. Fun fact that I'm sure everybody else knew: the last time Bob Chesney coached in a game, he went up against defense coordinator Tosh Lapoy at the University of Oregon, and his offense coordinator probably is very familiar with what Tosh Lapoy is doing. But he's got a new defense coordinator himself, Michael Hutchings, who is playing at, or he's a former De La Salle linebacker who was coaching at USC, played at USC, then went on to the NFL, will be his first game calling a defense in a college setting. And then Jordan Somerville, the brother of former UCLA defensive lineman Quentin Somerville, who's now an assistant at Cal, will be his first game as the play caller. So Chesney and Tosh already have some history. And then this recruiting road seemingly is bringing out a little bit more of a rivalry between UCLA and Cal. And, you know, people can say what they want about Calamony. You know, it is fun when UCLA and Cal have a little bit of beef towards each other. Wouldn't you say? Yeah.
You know, anytime, especially when you can get a old Pac-12 opponent and, you know, get a true road game and not have to go east. You know, that's its own victory there with the UCLA scheduling and that sort of thing. But like I touched on before with Lupoy and Chesney and, you know, just the recruiting battles that seem to have been set up for years to come. Should, you know, both programs be able to turn recruiting results into on-field victories? You know, you think of somebody like Charles Davis, who UCLA thought they had. You know, when we talked about Matthew Gregory and Nebraska thinking they had him, UCLA very much thought that, you know, they were going to get Charles Davis, the receiver out of Westlake. And, you know, Lupoy goes into Southern California and gets one. But again, like we mentioned, you know, UCLA returns the favor with getting Miles Baker. They were also both recruiting the likes of Duve Williams, who is now going to end up a little bit Sierra Canyon for his senior year. Deuce Jones-Drew, even though he was considering Cal, but, you know, he always felt like a UCLA pledge, just, you know, with his father's ties and everything like that. But again, somebody who goes to De La Salle, the same high school that produced Tosh Lupoy. And yeah, just, you know, a couple of guys like that. I believe Tracy's story also touched on, you know, Washington, as another that, you know, UCLA was kind of battling with here in the West region. So some very early recruiting battles, aside from just the, you know, the more obvious UCLA-USC battles that'll always continue to happen.
You know, if you want to go watch a future Bruin against a future Cal Bear, the day before the Bruins and the Bears play, you can do so with Cardinal Newman of Santa Rosa. Josh Booney, who's headed to the University of California, will be taking on De La Salle with Deuce Jones-Drew on the Friday night before the UCLA-Cal game at De La Salle. Cardinal Newman also has a defensive lineman that UCLA has offered, Easy Crichton. And then Cal is all over De La Salle linebacker Landon Miller, who UCLA has offered, who plays for KT Prep, which is coached by Deuce Jones-Drew. So I don't think we've seen the last of Cal and UCLA battling on the recruiting trail, and we'll get to see them playing each other up in Strawberry Canyon in September and then back at the Rose Bowl next year. But yes, UCLA for this class, at least, Juju Johnson, Jerry Ahaus, George Tuia, Poli Boala, Kingston Silafi, Montana Toilola, and Rob Larson, all were guys that UCLA and Cal were going head-to-head on. Now, a couple of those guys, like a Jerry Ahaus, Cal had never really gotten a lot of traction with, but one that UCLA had certainly, you know, beat other good schools for, but Cal will take that. Dane Weber flips the script a little bit, goes to UCLA, but then, or goes to Cal, sorry, but then UCLA down the stretch gets Thurman Lyles, who was originally at Elk Grove High School before he transferred to Sacramento Grant, and then Miles Baker. So we should be seeing those battles plenty of times over the next couple of years. You know, the one that was interesting that I didn't really think of until you, Tracy, pointed out was UCLA and Penn State. Had a couple of spirited battles. We already mentioned Montana Toilolo, then George Tuia. You know, when the Big Ten expanded a couple of years ago, I think there was a thought like, hey, is this going to, you know, hurt UCLA especially, where at that time when the decision was made to go to the Big Ten, Chip Kelly was still the coach. And we knew that he didn't like to recruit. Was this going to make the West Coast even more open to the rest of the Big Ten? And Penn State, you know, their first round draft pick this year was from the state of Washington. All right. They've done well recruiting out West in the last couple of years. There's a defensive back who's Darian Green-Warren, who signed with Penn State a year ago. So Penn State's had some success, but now you got Danton Lynn, who spent a year at UCLA and then 2 years at USC. You've got Akiko Molloy. And so UCLA and Penn State went at it for a couple of players from the West Coast in George Tawia and in Montana Toilolo. But the ones that were the more surprising ones, if you will, were Matthew Gregory and Trey Hopkins, who, you know, both were, if James Franklin's the head coach at Penn State, who knows? Maybe those guys are still going to Penn State. But he's not. They didn't go to Virginia Tech. They chose UCLA. So might we see some more UCLA-Penn State battles in the coming years here, Tracy?
Yeah, no, that's definitely a very strong possibility, because you mentioned, you know, Danton Lynn and Ikaka Molloy, their own UCLA ties. But then you think, especially you look at somebody like Ikaka Molloy, you know, aside from just his time at UCLA, also spent time at Washington, recruits that area really well. And that's obviously an area that UCLA has historically recruited. So definitely someone who even I saw him out at the modern day college showcase back in the spring and you know, chopped it up with him a little bit. That was that, and also saw him at St. John Bosco. And those were the first times I had seen him since, you know, UCLA and him parted ways. Someone who's, you know, in good spirits, you know, someone who definitely didn't want to go out the way at all. All transpired, but yeah, someone who is definitely going to continue to recruit Southern California and go after some similar targets that UCLA will be involved with, especially with you know, UCLA and Penn State being in the Big Ten together. So yeah, definitely, especially on the defensive side, you can plan to see some UCLA Penn State ties there with. Recruiting battles in the future.
You know, it's interesting because we talked about, obviously, Oregon has had massive success recruiting Southern California for quite some time. Obviously, Washington has recruited Southern California quite some time. Ohio State has very famously recruited the West Coast well, going back to CJ Stroud, their starting quarterback right now, Julian Sain from San Diego, who Chip Kelly, interestingly enough, offered way back in the day. You know, they just got a commitment from Austin Miller, who UCLA was one of the first Power Four offers for out of Bellflower. You know, the roster is Epistatale, who was committed to UCLA for much of the cycle in the 2025 class, ultimately ended up at Ohio State. But, you know, Penn State is one that I think that there could be some more battles, just given, like you said, Lynn and Molloy having those West Coast ties. But, you know, in the 2 years that UCLA has been in the Big Ten, 2 years ago, Penn State was a bad Drew Aller interception away from potentially playing for a national title, where they likely would have reunited against Ohio State, who, you know, had to rally to beat them in State College earlier in the season. But if you remember, that was the first game Justin Martin started. He had to go on the road, and UCLA kept that game decently close, despite not being a very good team at that point in the year. And then last year, obviously, they broke Penn State entirely. So is UCLA-Penn State the new rivalry, Tracy, that we didn't think we wanted or we didn't think we needed, but we're going to get? Is UCLA-Penn State going to become such a rivalry that they play each other every year in the Big Ten play? More importantly, Tracy, is UCLA-Penn State going to become the rivalry that makes UCLA a whiteout game for the Nittany Lions? The streets are saying that it may be.
Yeah, it's funny you bring up the whiteout game. That was one I remember Deshaun Foster was kind of hoping that they were going to get, just to, you know, get that that hostile feel that, you know, that Penn State crowd can produce when they do that annual that annual game. But yeah, you know, it's you mentioned things you necessarily didn't see coming, right? Like UCLA's been a little bit of a thorn in their side. So, you know, and then UCLA still has some Big Ten opponents that they've yet to, you know, fully get entrenched with. It. We'll still have to see. You know, Michigan comes to mind. They haven't, you know, come to UCLA yet and that sort of thing. So, this whole, you know, conference realignment is, you know, even a couple years later, is still a little bit odd to get used to, you know, some of these matchups that now produces. But that, coupled with the recruiting side of things, does make for some interesting familiarity, especially, like we touched on before with Dan Lynn now being there, Keiko Malone now being there, you know, that there's a little bit more to it than meets the eye when you think about UCLA and Penn State being in football games.
If you look at UCLA's schedule this year in terms of, you know, who they get on the road, I think, you know, they did play at Penn State in year one, but it was a morning game. I think it was the Big Noon kickoff game. But I know that, you know, you circle some of those games. I know we're getting a little bit off topic from the recruiting standpoint, but these are things that I think are appealing to recruits and certainly are appealing to fans is, you know, who does UCLA play at home? I think right now, if you look at a weekend that could be a big visit weekend in terms of, you know, I expect that UCLA will have a good number of recruits at quite a few of their games, but they have a little bit of a stretch there in October where they get Wisconsin at home. And obviously Wisconsin might be a little bit down as they've been compared, you know, to years past. And then they get Michigan State the following weekend. Then they get Nevada, which is a little bit of a clunker of a game, probably won't bring out a big fan base. It's also the night of Halloween. But, you know, if you look at some of the key weekends for recruits and for visits, I would say that right now that October 17th, October 24th weekend with Wisconsin and Michigan State back-to-back will be significant. The problem with the USC game is that now that game being Thanksgiving weekend, that's also the same weekend, if I am accurate, that's the same weekend the CIF finals, all across the Southern Section finals. So with that likely being a Saturday night game as it has been the last couple of years, with the NBC late crowd, you know, that could hamper teams that are in the championship games in terms of recruits, but also, you know, being so late in the day, you know, those games are going head to head against CIF championship games, but that will be something that we will be touching on here in the coming weeks. You know, who can we expect to see on the sidelines at UCLA games in the coming months? In terms of, you know, there's no Friday night game this year at the Rose Bowl, I don't believe, like there was last year.
There might be.
Is it Minnesota that was? No, there was Minnesota.
They announced Iowa. Two early games. I'd have to double check on
that. You're right. It is the UCLA-Illinois game is a Friday night. So right now in the month of November, their last week, that's why those Wisconsin-Michigan State games are going to be so crucial, because you get Nevada on the 31st, then they're on the road at Minnesota, they get Illinois at home on a Friday night, then they go to Michigan, then they got SC on the weekend of Thanksgiving, but CIF championship, and you know the game against San Diego State, September 12th, that's a 4:15 game. That should bring a decent crowd. The heat should be a little bit less. And they get Purdue the following week at 8 o'clock on the West Coast. So I would imagine the Michigan State, you know, it's funny because if you look back, one of their most crucial weekends for visits last year was the Penn State game. And that was their first home game after the firing of Deshaun Foster. And it turned out to be a big win for them. It saved their season in a sense that it kept them from going winless. But if I remember, they ended up offering quite a few guys. They didn't end up getting those guys, but they offered quite a few guys. But if I remember, that was the weekend that they really started to turn it up with Juju Johnson, even with the staff that didn't know if they were going to be there for that much longer. So there's something about some of those October games that still can be crucial. So again, Wisconsin, Michigan State, we'll go through the schedule here in the coming weeks just to give us something to touch on what weekends should be what are some of the key games in Southern California. But circle the San Diego State game weekend because I would anticipate Kahuku High School will be playing at St. John Bosco the night before. Ciale Reed, who earned an invitation to the Under Armour All-American game out of Kahuku, who lined up next to Malaki Soliatui, said he plans to be at the Rose Bowl that day. Chase, we're getting that much closer to the football season. We're getting that much closer to you being up on the parking structure for how long did I give you guys a practice now? It'll be different because this will be the first actual season you're getting to cover under Chesney. But what was the viewing schedule like for you guys during spring ball?
Yeah, actually, they definitely improved things. And we, you know, in years past, we were up on the parking structure for practices the last, you know, couple of Chip Kelly years. But this year, they actually got us on the field. They even let us, you know, before they'd put us in one corner and we'd primarily be stuck watching most of the cornerbacks and safeties. Those are the position groups closest to us. This spring, the SID staff and Chesney himself really listened to what those of us in the media would have liked to see as far as access went. And we got to see not only a lot more practice, some live 11-on-11 periods, but we also got to see more position groups as we were, kind of chaperoned around for a period or two to, watch offensive linemen or get a closer look at the quarterbacks and that sort of thing. So, that was a big credit to the media relations staff at UCLA and Chesney himself for, wanting to make it as open as they can with, your obvious, let's say negotiation of what, what we can and can't see and that sort of thing. That's, very understandable. And, and one thing I also want to touch on that you were talking about with the, recruiting and some of these game atmospheres, the one thing we still need to see with Chesney now is to see just how many people he can bring back to the Rose Bowl. Because really the biggest attended game that I can remember in the last couple of years would have been UCLA Colorado, either two, maybe three seasons ago.
2023.
Yeah. So, but other than that, they were getting drowned out by the likes of New Mexico. Like you mentioned, that's a fan base that traveled very well. And obviously New Mexico pulled the upset that triggered the firing of Deshaun Foster. Now they're going to have to, Chesney and his staff are going to now have to prove that they can pack the Rose Bowl with the UCLA fans and not have it be, just almost dead for most of these games, especially, when you think about some non-conference games that they should be able to put a stamp on and maybe create some waves with and, possibly get some big wins out of to generate more interest. So that's the other thing I'm going to be looking for this upcoming year is just how different the Rose Bowl feels now that Chesney's in charge.
Well, it can't be any more moribund than it had been under the latter part of the Chip Kelly era. And like you said, that ever memorable New Mexico thriller on a Friday night in September. But that's where it's led to the point now that UCLA has optimism for the first time. If you are a connoisseur of college football podcasts, in addition to the Podcast of Champions or the Brocast, there's a lot of other college football podcasts that are out there that have saying, hey, there could be a surprise team this year. And that it's going to be one to watch in the Big Ten could be UCLA. I think UCLA fans will take that. And a lot of reason for optimism, a lot of reason for excitement. And part of that is because of the recruiting efforts that Bob Chesney and his staff has done. It's made it fun. They beat good teams. No more Colorado School of Mine victories. They are now beating schools that actually are worth gold as programs, not just mining for gold. On that note, my jokes today have been terrible, but I at least acknowledge that they aren't very good. We will be back next week and we will touch on a little bit more of some of the fun things that have gone on, but then we'll also next week, I think our plan is we're going to start diving in a little bit more into the 28 and the 29 classes because you have to. You almost have to, especially the 2028s. That becomes the focus of the fall. That becomes the focus of the games in the fall. So we will start touching on who are some of the key 2028 players that UCLA really needs to make a push for, that they have a really realistic chance for, all while David Woods is in Chicago, my kind of town. Tracy McDowell and I will be back next week to touch on recruiting. But for now, we thank you for listening. So for Tracy, I'm Brandon. Thanks for listening.